You're listening to an RNIB Connect Radio podcast.
We find out now here on RNIB Connect Radio about how a life-changing eye gene therapy treatment has been able to make a real change to the vision of Safi and other children with the eye condition Leber's congenital amaurosis. I'm delighted to say that I'm now joined by Safi's mother, Lisa Sanford, and Rob Henderson, consultant ophthalmologist at Great Ormond Street Hospital, who performed the treatment on Safi too. Welcome to RNIB Connect Radio, Lisa and Rob.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, Terry.
So firstly, Rob, do tell me a bit more about the eye condition Leber's congenital amaurosis and how it affects people's vision like Safi's. And is it more around, I suppose, issues in low lighting conditions such as in the evening or at night?
Sure. So Leber's or Leber's congenital amaurosis, depending on how you want to pronounce it, was described actually by a German ophthalmologist back in the late 1700s, and it really describes the most severe end of the retinal dystrophy continuum. And so typically a child who presents with Leber's will have eye movements called nystagmus, but they're roving eye movements. The eyes move in not any particular rhythmical fashion, but they're searching, if you like. And the vision is very poor. Poor both in light conditions and in dark conditions. And typically when we do electrical tests, electrodiagnostics, as we call it, there is no detectable electrical response in the retina. Now, there are 25 genes that we know of that can cause Leber's, and RPE65 is one of those. Now, interestingly, RPE65 can have quite a variable presentation. It can present as true Leber's. It can present slightly later as a severe early onset retinal dystrophy where a child might have some useful vision. And indeed, in Safi's case, she had some useful vision when the lights were bright. You turn the lights down even a fraction, however, with Safi, and she was effectively severely visually impaired. And that's a particular feature of this gene. Some of the other Leber's genes, it doesn't really matter what the lighting condition is like, you just have no vision at all. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does. That does. Lisa, do give me a little bit of an idea of what Safi's vision was like before the treatment, and what were the main indicators for you as her mother that she was having problems with her eyesight?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in those first couple of years, and we didn't notice it straight away, but really from about the age of about one, sort of family members started commenting on the fact that she was holding objects very, very close to her face. She used to not recognise the sort of faces of family members. She cried a lot. But I suppose if it's your first child, some of that we didn't recognise as being different, you know, or abnormal, I hate to use the word, but you know what I mean? And so eventually after going for lots of different eye tests, she was diagnosed as highly myopic, so very, very short-sighted, so minus 12 then actually, when she was 2.5. So we thought, oh, that's what it is. You know, she's minus 12. She's got her glasses on now. You know, obviously we were pretty worried about that, but also thinking, okay, well, she's got her glasses now and they might be able to do something about that when she's older. So we'll just sort of carry on. And as she got older and she started, you know, walking and things, we sort of began to feel it really still isn't quite right. She'd always struggled in the dark and she'd always sort of walk towards any source of light in the house and sort of stand and stare at it, you know, at lampshades and things. And of course, we were quite naive to that. And we just really thought, oh, is that what you're like then when you're minus 10? Had no idea anything else was going on, you know, at all at this point, that we were under Moorfields in Bedford and they transferred us to Moorfields in London. And in the summer of 2024, they did the brain scans that Rob was referring to. And that's when it sort of started to dawn on us, oh, actually, something else is going on here. This is all getting quite, you know, serious. And of course, the results came back that she had night blindness and we had to have blood tests. They went off to America, which was 3 months away. And in those, like, you know, agonizing 3 months, you know, you do your research, you do your Googling and you realize that most causes of night blindness are a form of retinitis pigmentosa. And that's when we started to really realize that not only was her eyesight far worse than we'd ever imagined, and there was probably something else going on, but actually it could get worse and it could lead to complete blindness. And that's when we were really sort of hit rock bottom, if you like, you know, emotionally.
And Rob, how does this eye gene therapy treatment work? And am I right in thinking that there were greater results with children of Safi's age compared to older children? And if so, why is that so?
Sure. So gene therapy is essentially, the premise of it is to try and replace defective genes. And in this particular instance, what we need to do is to introduce a healthy copy of the RPE65 gene into the cells of the retina where it's most needed. So RPE65, the gene, what it does essentially is to create fuel for the photoreceptors that allows them to turn light into an electrical signal. So we need to get a healthy copy of this gene into the layer underneath the retina, which we call the pigment epithelium. And the way we do that is we use a unique property of viruses. Viruses are essentially perfectly engineered postal mechanisms for DNA. If you think about a cold virus, you breathe it in, it attaches itself to your nasal mucosa, it posts the cold virus's DNA into your nasal mucosa, and then your nasal cells start making lots of new copies of the virus. Well, what we do is we take something called an adeno-associated virus. This is a virus that doesn't actually cause disease in humans. And we strip out the virus's own DNA and we put into that virus a healthy copy of the gene of interest, in this case, obviously RPE65. And then we make hundreds of billions of copies of that adeno-associated virus. And we then do an operation. So it's an operation that we do quite commonly. It's called a vitrectomy, where I go in through three tiny little holes made through the white part of the eye. And I remove the jelly, the vitreous, as we call it. And then I inject, using a very, very fine needle, a solution containing these billions of viruses underneath the retina. So you've got a blister, if you like. The retina is lifted up, and underneath that is this solution of viruses. And they do their job. They start to post the DNA, the RPE65, into the cells of the retinal pigment epithelium, the RPE. And then over a period of 1 to 4 weeks, the cell recognizes that it's got some new instructions, and it starts to make healthy RPE65 protein. And a bit like an old car that requires a bit of turning over, it takes some time for the retina to start to work, but it does. And the effects are, often amazing. So in the trial, what we saw, there were a number of trials, but in the final phase three trial, which is the main phase where we submit the data to the regulators, and in that, what we saw was that adults and teenagers and older children, who were the majority of the trial participants, got improvement in their low illumination vision. So their nighttime vision got better. And that's because their rod cells, the rod cells are the nighttime cells, those were starting to work better. There was no real signal that the daytime cells, the cones, were doing anything much. And there were lots of theories as to why that might be. But essentially, it was concluded that this was really a treatment for improving your nighttime or your low illumination vision. And that was good. I mean, let's not underestimate just how incapacitating having no low illumination vision is. I mean, Lisa will tell you, it really slows everything down. But what we started to notice is that if we treated younger children, and I was quite keen to test the hypothesis that maybe their cone cells had also been activated. But you see, if your brain has never learnt to see fine vision, which, if you don't have good vision from the outset, you'll never learn to see, then it doesn't matter if you switch the lights on a bit later, you're not going to know what to do with that image. And so my hypothesis was, if we treat in what we call the critical period of visual development, that's the first 2 or 3 years, then maybe you'll start to see that the daytime vision also improves. And certainly our data would seem to support that hypothesis.
And would this type of gene therapy treatment work for all types of Leber's congenital amaurosis, or just some types like the ones that Safi has?
So that's a great question. And in theory, most what we call recessive disorders, where there are spelling mistakes in both copies of the gene that you've inherited, one from your mum and one from your dad. In theory, if the retina itself isn't too damaged and the cells are still alive, then gene therapy should work. Now, there are a couple of problems because often the retina is very severely damaged from a very early age in some form of Leber's. And so You can't bring dead cells back to life with gene therapy. It requires the cells to be there, dormant, not really working. And hopefully, if you introduce the right protein, then things will start to work again. So I think that's a long-winded way of saying it probably will work in some other forms of labors, but is unlikely to work in all of them.
So, Lisa, how much of a difference has the treatment made to Safi's life and to you as her mother too? As I think when Safi was running down a path trick-or-treating, like every young person will do on Halloween, that she said to you, oh, gosh, I can see, which must have been a wonderful thing for you to hear.
It's made such a difference to our lives. It's really difficult to put it into words. As Rob said, you know, as she got older, in the year or two sort of leading up to surgery, she was sort of 4 or 5 years old. Every daily activity was really hard for us, especially in winter time. You know, her peripheral vision was pretty poor as well. You know, you'd leave something lying on the floor at the laundry basket, she'd go flying over it, bless her. And, you know, she just wouldn't see hazards come in. It was really difficult, like I said, at night time, but actually all low-level light was really hard. We relied on torches really heavily, like all sorts of different types of torches. One that you could stand on a table, you know, over. She couldn't see her dinner in winter time. Children's parties were hard. We couldn't go and play indoor golf. You know, you go to someone's house and it's quite dark. You've got the torches out. It really impacted her massively, and she missed out on an awful lot. It was really, really hard to sort of see her struggling. You know, we'd go on holiday, go out for an evening meal, and you had to walk her to the toilet, and it was literally like walking a blind child. She could see very so little. And obviously, we knew the surgery was coming up, and you know, Rob explained it's difficult to sort of predict what the results might be like. So we just thought, okay, if we get any improvement at all, we'll be so happy. And the biggest thing for us was, you know, we've been previously told that without treatment, she'd go blind by the age of 30. So we were just hopeful to push that date back as far as we could. I could never have imagined what it would be like in the reality, you know, literally a week post first surgery. My husband took a video of us, you know, putting her to bed as we always do, covered up the eye that hadn't been done and she couldn't see anything, uncovered the eye that had just been operated on. She could point at my face for the very first time. I could see she was looking at objects in her room. She was telling me what they were. We got the trick or treating. That was amazing. And ever since then, touch wood, it's been now a year since her first operation, just over. And life is completely different for us. She's a completely different child. You know, she wouldn't really run free before. She was very ginger, very guarded, very nervous around new people and places and busy places as well. And now, you know, touch wood, we barely even sort of think about it anymore, except to sort of think every day how utterly grateful we are, because it's been so astonishing. She can see everything. She's caught up with her peers in terms of sort of physical activities, things like riding a bike, you know, things like swimming. They're all back on the table now. It's absolutely remarkable.
Oh, that's amazing to hear. Rob, having performed this treatment on children, including Safi, could this type of treatment help people with other inherited eye conditions at all?
I mean, obviously, this particular one is directed directly at RPE65. So they are gene specific. And with over nearly 300 genes that cause all the various forms of retinal dystrophy, of RP, of macular dystrophies, everything that people are aware of, we have a long time to go before we've chipped off each of those ones. And there are other approaches, what we call gene agnostic approaches, being taken now. There are newer technologies that might allow us to treat dominant conditions, not just recessive conditions. And there are a burgeoning number of trials that have data that looks really encouraging. So I've just come back from our big science meeting in the US, ARVO, and there was some really lovely data for trials that are now going into phase three. And, you know, we're crossing our fingers that it's not going to be quite as long as it took us to get, you know, RP65 over the line. So I am cautiously optimistic that we will have more treatments coming in the next few years.
And finally, Rob, if people would like to find out more about the eye gene therapy treatment for Leber's congenital amaurosis, as well as other eye research projects, where would be the best place for people to go to find out more?
So we have a very good resource based at Moorfields, where I also work, which is called gene.vision. And that's a really good information resource. There are obviously the charities, including RNIB, Retina UK, and others that have a lot of information, Macular Society. So those are the places that I would generally tend to go first before delving too deeply into Google, because unfortunately, there's a huge amount of misinformation alongside great information. So that's probably where I would start.
Well, thank you so much indeed, Lisa and Rob, for chatting with me here on RNIB Connect Radio and for telling me more about this amazing life-changing eye gene therapy treatment that has made a real difference to Safi and other young children with Leber's congenital amaurosis.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Toby.
For more interviews, features and shows, go to your favourite podcast provider and search for RNIB Connect Radio.